Hello and welcome to episode 2 in our Unraveling HS Exploring Hidradenitis Suppurativa series. This podcast series is dedicated to shedding light on the often misunderstood world of hidradenitis suppurativa. Join us as we embark on a journey to explore the challenges and triumphs of treating and researching this condition. In this episode, a panel discusses 5 different cases and highlights their research priorities when it comes to pediatric HS. Before we begin, it's important to note that this podcast is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Any decisions related to medical care should be made in consultation with a qualified healthcare provider. Now, I would like to formally introduce our program hosts. Dr. Irene Lara Corrales is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Toronto and staff physician at Hospital for Sick Children. She is a co-chair for PEDRA's Acne and HS Focus Study Group. Co-chairing this program, as well as the Acne and HS Focus Study Group with Dr. Lara Corrales, is Dr. Colleen Cotton. Dr. Cotton is an assistant professor of dermatology and pediatrics at George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and a pediatric dermatologist at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for organizing and hosting this series. I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Jen. We are so excited to be joined today by 3 pediatric HS superstars who are going to be discussing some of these cases with us. Our first guest joining us today is Dr. Jennifer Shao. She's an associate professor of dermatology at the University of Southern California, where she directs a hidradenitis suppurativa clinic. She is dedicated to improving the medical care and quality of life for patients with this challenging condition through direct patient interaction as well as research.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Welcome. So our second speaker is Dr. Jennifer Ruth. Dr. Ruth is an assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Texas, Bell Medical School in Austin, Texas. At her home institution, she serves as the pediatric dermatology clerkship director, wellness director for the Division of Dermatology, and she is also an active member of the Research Resident Education Committee. Her clinical and research interests include hyperhidrosis, hidradenitis suppurativa, and chronic inflammatory skin diseases. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. And lastly, we're joined by Dr. Rebecca Levy. She's a staff physician in the Division of Dermatology at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Ontario, and an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Toronto. Her clinical and research interests include skin toxicities of targeted anti-cancer therapies, late cutaneous effects post-hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, and hidradenitis suppurativa in the pediatric population. She's active in education at all levels, acting as co-director of the Biennial Pediatric Dermatology Update Conference, and is the fellowship director for the Clinical Pediatric Dermatology Fellowship at SickKids. Welcome, Dr. Levy.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're really excited today to really jump into cases and the management of HS. We kind of set the stage in the first podcast, putting kind of what HS is and all the new research and the new insights that we have on pathogenesis. But today we're going to go and review a few cases, really to kind of find out what others are doing and some ideas on how to manage some of these challenging cases. So we'll start with a kind of a milder case. So let's say that we have in clinic an 11-year-old patient, otherwise healthy, that comes to us because he's having some acne. The patient tells us that he's also getting pimples in other body areas. And when you examine the skin, we find comedones in the inguinal and axillary areas, but nothing else. So I don't know how many of you have seen similar cases, but I for sure have a few kids that present this way. Probably my first question to all of you, do you call this HS? Is this HS in your eyes? And what do you do with these patients? Like, how do you treat them?
I guess I can say I vote yes. I would call it HS. I mean, given those characteristic areas of involvement, I would feel pretty strongly about calling it that, but curious what you ladies think.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes it's helpful to see those other signs. So even if it is quiet, if we are seeing the open comedones, you know, and getting a history, maybe we can get a family history of HS in the family, that can help us out too. I would already be thinking also about, you know, when he calls it pimples in the other areas, but all we're seeing are the open comedones looking like, are there signs of scarring too? Can he describe what else he means by pimples? Are they really like not just the blackheads that we're seeing on exam today, but there was something else happening that we're just not seeing on exam today?
For sure. I totally agree. I think looking back retrospectively at whether he's had like any inflammatory nodules would be important. And if he hasn't, we can assume he's probably going to develop them at some point in the future.
And for a patient like this, what would be your first choice? Like, what would you start managing him with?
I think I would start pretty simple, like maybe with just an anti-inflammatory wash in those areas. And, you know, perhaps just trying to get in a good habit of utilizing something to try to help prevent further progression. And with an 11-year-old, I feel like maybe just a wash would be a good place to start, assuming that the exam lined up with what you're describing and they didn't tell us they had a lot of inflammatory nodules. But if it really was just, you know, the early brewing of this, that's how I'd go.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd probably focus at that point also on like lifestyle measures, friction, sweating, being physically active, you know, healthy choices from a dietary perspective if obesity is an issue in this patient, avoiding smoking, things like that.
Yeah, and I think getting a sense like, are there sort of other comorbidities that we might want to start thinking about as well? You know, how is he doing in terms of his overall weight? You know, are we worried about something like prediabetes already, and already maybe even thinking about like psychological comorbidities too, just in case? I think already starting to picture this person as someone who, you know, may have HS. It sounds very much like HS, but starting to think about the other adjunct things we can do.
So let's say that this patient is otherwise healthy, has no acanthosis, is not obese, only has comedones. How often do you think this patient should be followed? Like if it is something that is brewing and that they'll likely start developing some other inflammatory signs, like how often are you going to bring him back to your clinic to examine his skin?
That's a really tough question, especially in very resource limited settings where oftentimes our attention is needed by some of the more severe, challenging patients. I think following him probably 6 monthly or yearly would be nice if you have that capacity. If you don't, then perhaps warning them about signs that might bring them back to you would be important.
Gonna say, I think on this one, I would probably say if you were treating his acne, then I might, you know, for the first visit, say like, oh, that's something I usually see back in about 3 months. And then at the follow-up, just kind of reiterate, like, again, I have some concerns about, you know, what's in these other areas. And hopefully by hearing it a couple of times, get a little more buy-in about what's could be going on or what might happen. And then totally agree if else was, that was going well otherwise, then probably spacing out a bit to, you know, 6 months or more.
Yeah, I really like the idea of telling family members like when to bring the kiddo back, and also telling the child too, like what are signs that we would want maybe the doctor to see it when it's active. So allowing for that and letting them know like what number to call so that they can get in, not have to hopefully wait. And then, you know, the lesions, inflammatory lesions are gone again. But absolutely in the setting of like, you might be treating their acne anyway, you're probably going to see them back and can definitely just do an exam of the areas while they're back seeing you.
I really like when the kids you have like mostly just open comedones. Like my preferred wash is benzoyl peroxide based in those cases. And especially, and I feel like the younger kids, sometimes like a 10% wash daily is too much for them to handle. So that's another reason I like to bring those kids back in for like a 3 month visit and just make sure, like, is this irritating too much? Are you able to use it, or have you just completely stopped or given up? Do we need to go down on the percentage so that you can use it every day? Are you doing okay using it a few times a week? How would you guys pick your anti-inflammatory wash of choice? Mine is entirely anecdotal, but I'm curious how other people decide.
And can I just add to that question? Now, with all the benzoyl peroxide being in the news, have you changed anything that you're doing with this patient, and how are you handling the benzoyl peroxide conversation with HS families?
I'll take the benzoyl peroxide part. I mean, in that the study that you're referencing, they were storing it at very high temperatures that, you know, are very unlikely for our patients to be storing their medications at. So I admit it, I have not changed my practice at all in terms of I still utilize it. And I think a lot of it's based off, at least for me, for cost effectiveness, in the sense that for a lot of my Medicaid-based plans, I can get benzoyl peroxide covered, but if not, I can have a very easy, you know, over-the-counter numerous options for them to choose from if it wasn't. So that's my approach.
I'll also point out that the ones that they looked at, none of them were actually washes. Most of them were Nuvon products. And so since I almost exclusively use the wash, I'm not as worried about it. And I tell them I'm not as worried about it because I do think that we're not leaving this product on the skin. We're only leaving it there for a few minutes and then washing it off.
I agree. I use a lot of BP wash, like from 4 to 10%, depending on their tolerance and coverage and access and things like that. We also do a lot of dilute bleach baths for our patients as kind of an antiseptic option.
I think the other one that we can use is chlorhexidine gluconate wash. I think people just have varied preferences too when it comes to washes, and we just don't have the data to claim superiority of one versus another. So for me, like if they like their chlorhexidine gluconate wash, great, we'll stick with that. If they are willing to use the benzoyl peroxide one, that works too. And then, you know, we could also think about, you know, like a topical clindamycin in whatever form they prefer. Like I tend to start with lotion, but some people like wipes. But I feel like that's another one in terms of mild, you know, topical things we can do for milder HS.
Thank you. I think that is great. I think with especially this age group, like we sometimes have to find the one the patient likes, because that is what is going to, they're going to adhere and comply to the treatment if they like it. And sometimes that is kind of the trial and error that we have to do to find one that really they continue using. I'll pass it to Colleen. Maybe we can start with the second case.
We have a 13-year-old male coming in with Down syndrome. He is obese and is also known to be hypothyroid. He was referred to your clinic due to, quote unquote, recurrent skin infections. And so when we examine it in clinic, we find widespread folliculitis. And some of these pustules and papules do involve the axillary and inguinal area, but it is especially prominent in the buttock area. I get at least a couple of these patients in here, and I find them very challenging. But, you know, how do you differentiate between folliculitis and HS? And when do you go ahead and just say you have both of them? What is your approach to those patients?
I think it's such a common presentation, especially for children and adolescents with trisomy 21. We see it so commonly where they have that really kind of disseminated recurrent folliculitis picture combined with more typical HS lesions, but not always. I'm kind of calling it HS because I find the ones who just have folliculitis ultimately end up having more typical HS lesions in addition. I just see them so frequently together.
Yeah, I find that there's also sometimes other signs of follicular occlusion, like they also have bad KP, you know, so there's just like, it just looks like you're seeing someone who there's something wrong with the, you know, follicular proliferation or something where there's just hyperproliferation manifesting as different clinical manifestations of this follicular pathway that got obstructed somehow. And so for me, you know, I do feel like for some of these patients, I do try for example, like maybe trying Accutane or isotretinoin to help with that hyperproliferation component to see, especially if they also have concomitant acne, because typically, you know, I don't think that isotretinoin or going for an oral retinoid would be like your first choice for HS. But I think that's a setting where I might try it to see if, you know, we can help sort of calm some of that follicular or proliferation down.
Totally fair. I would say I agree with both of y'all that I think I'm more apt than not to call it HS if it's in those characteristic locations as well, like actually in the axillary vault or, you know, within the groin. But I perhaps not the most scientific assessment, but I'm like, it's kind of all on the spectrum. I think that's what you were describing, Jenny, where you're like, yeah, Your follicles just like to party in multiple different ways. And when I see it that diffusely, I'm probably going to be reaching for maybe something that honestly will help with both anyway, but I'm going to follow along and be staring at those other areas a bit more carefully.
I love that, party in multiple different ways. I just feel that. One other thing that we sometimes see, both in our patients with trisomy 21, as well as our patients with intellectual disability, is that treatment is sometimes challenging, as they may not be able to swallow pill formulations or tolerate, you know, the topical application of creams. So what are some of your tricks and your approach to management of those patients?
If they're really small tabs, then I found that stuffing them in a mini marshmallow works well, which is something that a patient with trisomy 21 taught me, or the family did. So no, that sounds silly, but if they're very small ones, then you can get away with that. And it's kind of a fun way, but I'd say otherwise, you know, looking for liquid formulations of things like, you know, doxy, which can sometimes be hard to come across. And then I think I'm spoiled in that I have a clinical pharmacist that works as part of our department. So sometimes if I'm really stuck, I will, you know, phone a friend and ask for, you know, other ideas or substitutions. But again, I think I might be a little lucky there.
Spironolactone can also come as a liquid formulation if we run into that. And I've run into cases where I think, you know, one of my patients with Down syndrome was hiding or stuffing away the pills. So then the lab found like a huge stash and had to come in and say like they didn't take any. And we actually ended up converting to actually doing a biologic and injection. So I feel like it really varies. Sometimes you think like an injection would be impossible because, you know, they can't take a pill. How are they going to be able to go through an injection? But you know, mom said it's actually easier. She does it for the patient together. The patient doesn't seem to mind it that much. And so I think it varies and it's important to sort of assess for preferences. I think in general, no matter what, with our adolescent patients to assess for preferences, in terms of delivery of medication, whether it's a vehicle for cream or for a topical or like pill versus injection, because sometimes it's surprising what we find. And it's not necessarily what we would expect. But if anyone else has tips on how to help people who cannot take pills take the medicines we want to, I'd love to hear it. It's really challenging.
Yeah, I make friends with my pharmacist. I mean, they're so, so helpful. Just knowing which capsules you can break open, which tabs you can crush, which meds you can compound into liquids. I really lean on them quite a bit.
But there's also things like the pill swallowing cups that you can get on Amazon. They're like $10. And like they have a little pocket where you put the pill that supposedly is tiny so that if you go to take a drink, it'll pop that pill back at the right time. So it can help people learn what it feels like to swallow a pill. But I have some patients who've just never gotten the hang of it without the cup and they just use the cup to do it. Well, those are all really good tips and tricks. But speaking of injections, are you worried? Because this comes up all the time when I am having the discussion about the risks of adalimumab. Are you worried about using biologics like that in patients with Down syndrome? And any tips on managing them, like how to counsel these patients?
That's a hard question. I had a colleague kind of go through this, have a case where they were worried that perhaps a patient they put on a biologic, you know, might have developed lymphoma because of having kind of like massive inguinal lymphadenopathy. It ended up not being, but I feel like I felt the feelings as well, you know, like talking and through that case. And so I would say, you know, my understanding is that, of course, you know, patients with trisomy 21 might have an increased risk of leukemia, not really lymphoma to my knowledge. But then in terms of our, you know, use of biologics, like we don't have great data really to, in my mind, to show how much of a concern that should be. I think I consider it low based off my own literature review. So I'm just trying to weigh the patient's quality of life versus that small and perhaps even questionable risk. But, you know, I think probably we do or wouldn't be doing our patients a good service if we weren't at least discussing the potential for this lowers your immune system, you know, in a small manner. You may already be at risk for certain types of, you know, cancers like leukemia. And so, you know, I wouldn't bring this up as an option if I didn't think it was, you know, a important consideration for your child's day-to-day health. This is a low risk long-term, but we need to pay attention and know before we start that everything has its potential risks and just make sure that they're on board. I feel like most of these patients, if we're getting to the point that we're talking about systemic, like this is something that's impactful on a day-to-day basis, and that concern is a lot greater than a perhaps small theoretical risk of a cancer.
I completely agree with you. I think having frank discussions and making sure you have informed consent is totally important. But in my mind, the risk, the very small risk of some sort of malignancy or lymphoproliferative disease or whatever is so small compared to the risks of not treating the HS.
I completely agree. And I also think something that makes me feel better is the fact that, like, we know that in a lot of our patients, it's not going to be adalimumab for life, right? Like, whatever biologic we choose so far, like, there's a lot of basically, like, we're hoping it can help. But, you know, over time, a lot of them lose efficacy, right? And we'll have to look for another agent to switch to. So I think that when I'm counseling patients and their families as well, I typically say, like, just because we're going to start this medication, it doesn't mean you're signing up to be on this for life. In fact, it could be that we're going to be switching it to something else, you know, in maybe just a couple of years. So there are things that we're talking about, but that way it kind of lifts that burden of, like, am I basically signing the box to say I'm going to be assuming this, like, risk because I'm going to be on this forever and ever. And I just don't think that that's something that I would expect over their clinical course.
So just a little advertisement here, like the PDRAS Down syndrome working group is putting together a paper on the use of biologics in patients with Down syndrome. So shortly, I hope it is going to be out. And I think, like, some of the questions and some of the things that we're discussing might be kind of elucidated by this paper, or at least we'll have some information on the use of biologics in this patient population.
I love that plug. And I think, you know, just really going off of what Jen and Rebecca were saying, like, I think it would just be a disservice to withhold a medication that could have a huge improvement on a patient's quality of life because of this, you know, small, perhaps, risk. And so I think that really having that open conversation and remembering that, you know, HS with that unchecked systemic inflammation, it's also a problem. So really thinking about how to phrase that in a risk-benefit scenario with patients and their families is important.
Okay, so now I'll set the stage for our next case. So let's suppose that we're seeing a 16-year-old female that has been complaining of intermittent boils in her underarms and groin for the last 3 years. She has had several of them every month, reports as well to have irregular menses, and her body mass index is above the 99th percentile. On exam, she has acanthosis nigricans, has some striae. Mom tells us that the patient has not had any blood work or anything for the last 2 years. So this is probably one of my favorite topics, and we're going to dig in into comorbidities and how we are monitoring and how we're screening and how we're managing them. In a patient like this, are you routinely checking for comorbidities? And if you are, what are you checking for?
Since we started our HS clinic, we've really been using that as a venue to thoroughly screen for comorbidities in all of our patients. So we're screening with history, physical, and lab investigations. And we're really screening for all the sort of metabolic comorbidities, nutritional comorbidities. We're screening for inflammatory arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, PCOS in our female population. We're screening for substance use and abuse and mental health issues. We're screening for auto-inflammatory conditions as well, in addition to other sort of cutaneous diseases that can travel alongside HS.
I also work in that HS clinic, but I would like Rebecca to clarify what type of patients are the ones coming to clinic, just because some of the patients with very mild disease, we might not be approaching or screening the same way. So can you tell us what kind of patients are the ones coming to our HS clinic?
Yes, absolutely. So our intake criteria is that you have to have failed at least one systemic therapy. So these are all kids who have at least been on systemic antibiotics, if not also been started on biologic therapies so far. and they've already seen a dermatologist as well.
With HS, I just think there's so many comorbidities that we can screen for that I think for, at least for also like our, you know, fellow practitioners who may not have an HS specialty clinic, just to be aware of the importance of making sure your patient is plugged in with a pediatrician and getting regular checkups. Because I do feel like a lot of the things that are covered during an annual physical with like blood pressure and, you know, weight check and screening for typically hemoglobin A1C for diabetes, lipid. But I do think knowing what the patient's insurance status is as well and like their ability to get in to see primary care is really important, because if I'm getting a sense that I'm not sure if someone's going to check their hemoglobin A1C or check their lipid panel, I'm just going to go ahead and order it. And then in my clinic, everyone, adolescents, adults, get screened with a PHQ-2. And I think that, you know, just using a quick and easy, like, two-question screen for depression to know if you need to do further workup can be really helpful. It's interesting because actually, in some cases, it hasn't really lined up necessarily with how severe someone's HS may be on presentation. I think that just speaks to the various different things that go into mental health, things like anxiety and depression. I found that to be really helpful because you can use that screen then as a guide to start the discussion, because someone might seem totally okay, but actually on the screening question, you find out, oh my gosh, it's like 6 out of 6. I'm very high risk for major depressive disorder.
Wow, guys, hearing y'all talk, I have some aspirations of things I'd like to do in my clinic. I know we don't have an HS clinic where I practice. So patients I see are just, you know, in the like potpourri of like, all right, 15-minute visit, says it's for acne. Then you go and you're like, oh, nope, not acne. Here's HS, you know? And so I feel like truthfully, what I honestly accomplish in most visits is more things that are visible, right? Like, of course, like, oh, I see you have acne. I see you have acanthosis nigricans, or I see that, you know, perhaps someone has a larger body habitus. Those are things that I'm going to bring up in that visit. And then like you were mentioning, Jenny, often I'm asking like, oh, I see your pediatrician is such and such. When was the last time you saw them? And trying to see if it feels like they have a good relationship. And if that's something that if I, you know, I'm asking them like, hey, these are things I'd like you to follow up with, that I feel confident they have the, you know, a clear pathway as to how to do that. And if not, then I will start it, you know, things like checking hemoglobin A1C, or like you said, checking lipids, just to kind of get the ball rolling. Cause I feel like sometimes, not that I want to see those tests be positive, but when they are, then it's a helpful, like, okay, well, this is something we really need to focus on. And I need someone else to help me out doing this. And that's where your pediatrician comes into play for, you know, some of these. So I think having a team, even if you don't have a team in the clinic with you, is important, or to try to build one around the patient to help them out.
I think I do want to make the point too, because I think I'm also spoiled. I have my multidisciplinary HS clinic, but we don't see all our HS patients in that clinic. And I think it's important to remember that we don't have to do all of this on our first visit with that patient. You know, we can, if we're just trying to get them to understand what the condition is and like cool it down, we can start there. And then maybe the next time they come back, say, hey, you know, I'm glad you're doing better, or I see we're not doing better. You know, let's talk about some of the different factors that can play into this and can be triggers for some people, so that you're not, you know, every new HS patient is not a 30, 45 minute visit.
Yeah, we definitely, I think that was really the impetus for us to start the clinic, was that we were just really struggling in the general clinic to kind of tick all the boxes and screen for everything that we wanted to. So looking at comorbidities was really a major driver for actually starting the clinic in the first place. And then the second thing was sort of developing and building this network of specialists who have an interest in treating patients with HS, like from rheumatology and IBD. And then for us, we don't see adult patients. So having people on the adult side who we can transition to, starting those conversations and bringing them into the fold was really important and has been working nicely.
I think it's important to help people understand that like you can do a lot for a patient with HS, even in those 15 to 20 minutes, if you just like take the time to listen and establish that rapport. And just like Colleen said, like you can do more over time, so that, you know, I think the hope is that, you know, when somebody sees a patient with HS on their schedule, it's not going to be as like, oh no, this means that I'm going to fall like 30, 45 minutes behind, but rather like, okay, I'm going to try to do as much as I can in this visit. And knowing that if you had to sort of boil it down to like key partners in care, like super key, like thinking about that primary care doctor, to help with the overall health, thinking about psychiatry and therapy just because of that mental health aspect, and then perhaps a surgeon if you need it for those cases where you can't do the surgeries yourself. But like beyond those three, like, yes, it's extra and it's good to have those set up partners, but you can do a lot even if you don't have like a preset huge network or even people in like a multidisciplinary clinic with you.
I completely agree, Jenny. I think we're building all those bridges for the patients to get better care as we do this. Like, we're also educating and teaching many of those other specialists that might not be as familiar with HS. But now when we send somebody for, let's say we send them to GI, and the people that we're referring to are already familiar with HS, so they know the questions that we have. They guide us on how to combine treatments, because I think one of the things that we should probably discuss and bring up is how we are kind of using different treatments and combining treatments to treat more than HS. So, like, many of the things that we use are also being used to treat some forms of arthritis and some GI problems. So how are you doing this? How do you connect with all these other specialists, and how are you managing these combined treatments?
I think with, certain of the medications that we'll think about, like metformin or spironolactone or birth control pill, I think for derms, we feel very comfortable just initiating and saying like, oh, and if there is a component of, you know, PCOS or prediabetes, like, you can also help with those. So I won't necessarily like touch base with everyone if I think that, you know, this is just going to be something that can help multiple conditions. I think it gets a little more tricky when we're thinking about maybe a comorbidity where I'm not sure that the other specialist will want me to use a certain medication, then definitely I think, you know, making that contact to make sure we're all on the same care page is important. But definitely I think what's helpful about HS and like the metabolic hormonal comorbidities is that there are treatments that can really help with just more than just the HS.
We all feel and we all know that there are no clear guidelines or kind of any consensus statement or anything of how to follow and how to screen and how to monitor for comorbidities. It's definitely on the working plans of the Acne NHS PDRA subgroup, and something that we are definitely going to continue discussing to see how we make that happen. But for now, with the things that are out there, are there any specific tools that you endorse or any specific tools that you have been using that might be helpful for others to find or use in their clinics?
This is not a screening tool, since I already told you that's like room for improvement in my practice, I think. But I would say just a tool in general that I use is like the HS Foundation, their handout on HS. I feel like I print that all the time, both because it's in English and also in Spanish, because I see a heavily Spanish-speaking population. But I think it's just so helpful, like, to have written word about this as well, because like you guys were describing, we can't do it all in one visit. And I feel like I'm trying to impart a little bit of knowledge about a very complex disorder, and it's nice to have like things written out for them to review. I usually am like, okay, got a piece of homework, look this over, and when come back next time, we'll talk about it a little bit more. So I feel like, patient education obviously is a really big part of it. And I very much like that, like, simple and free and easy to find tool. And then they can also nose around on that website more too, if they're interested.
I think the HS Foundation website is super helpful. And then also there is the free resource, the HS Patient Guide that we had put together. I think some of you are authors on it too, that basically has, it's really comprehensive, but I think that sometimes parents and, you know, adolescents, they want to read more, and it's nice to have like an accurate resource. So at hspatientguide.com, which I tell my patients about, they can go in, they can read it. If they have questions, they can come back and ask me at the next visit. So I think that's another helpful resource that's out there.
And I'll put in a plug for the SPD handouts. There's one for HS and one actually specifically for HS in trisomy 21, which we use all the time, and they're really, really great.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. So moving on to case four. You have a 15-year-old who comes in with multiple draining sinus tracts in the groin and axillae. She is using scented maxi pads to try to cover up the smell and stuffing kind of toilet paper under her arms and into her underwear for the drainage. She was previously on adalimumab for 6 months, specifically Humira. She's had some improvement, but now her insurance is requiring that she change to a biosimilar, and she's very nervous about switching and that she may lose the benefit that she's had. Sometimes the odor of HS is the biggest limitation for patients to be able to attend school or be able to socialize, especially that fear of a spot opening up and that smell suddenly coming out of nowhere. Are there specific things that you're doing to control the odor? And similarly, you know, the drainage, how do you help patients control the drainage from their wounds?
I have two answers to that question. I think, first of all, really good quality wound care is so important. Up in Ontario, where I live, we have our wound care services that are provided free of charge to all patients, which is so, so fortunate. So we really make use of that, and they provide all the supplies free of charge as well, which is, I know, huge and very, very lucky. And you need good wound care in order to help control drainage in an effective way. So that's number one. For odor, I quite like topical metronidazole. I've been using that more and more, like Metrogel or Nortate, any kind of topical metronidazole formulation, I find works nicely for odor for a lot of patients. I have a colleague too who's tried the outer, like actually crushing the tablets, but we tried to prescribe it recently and like the pharmacy had a fit about it being, I don't know, like a carcinogen or something. So we backed away from that idea.
I think sort of going back to really discussing with the family how treating the HS should be like also a priority, because controlling that inflammation and getting the amount of drainage down is helpful. I think, you know, the wound care, I mean, I hope the goal is to get them to a point where they won't need like all the dressings and bandages anymore. Of course, it takes time to get to that point, but that is a key point that I emphasize, which is that like, let's get that inflammation under control. Let's get that drainage under control. And also with the drainage under control, see if that helps the odor as well.
I mean, I think what both of y'all said makes a lot of sense. And I would approach it similarly. I feel like usually, like you, Jenny, I'm usually trying to argue for increasing therapy if the drainage is so severe, right? That tells me maybe that we're not doing the best job of controlling. I think it can depend on if it's just like one site or multiple sites too, right? Obviously, if you just have one area that keeps being an issue, like maybe that's a good candidate for something more procedural or surgical in that one site. But from like specifically a, like if we're just talking about bandages, et cetera, I'm very jealous of you, Rebecca, and what you have. I feel like often I'm more trying to help educate people about like, okay, here's how DME works and here's how we can try to help you figure out who your DME provider, your durable medical equipment provider is, and put an order for bandages, like kind of trying to help hold hands. And then I feel like sometimes it reminds me a little bit of epidermolysis bullosa, where we're talking about wound care. And I'm like, I have some ideas that I have learned, but honestly, I've learned them from patients. And sometimes the best person to ask is another patient that has this. So like, again, getting involved in a patient support group so that they can ask those questions too of a peer that will understand it even more, you know, intimately than I can.
Dr. Levy, you touched a little bit on this where you are, that you have some access to this, but I'm curious, you know, wound care being very costly, it's definitely something that will be managed differently depending on where you live and if your patient even has insurance or not. I'm curious any specific tips and tricks that you guys have for accessing wound care, getting things covered. I know for us, we have leaned a lot on our wound care nursing team. They've actually come to shadow with us in our HS clinic a couple of times to sort of walk us through, you know, if you want something to be covered, these are the things that you have to include in the note specifically, like the size of the affected area. And I used to be trying to like, you know, measure out each individual little sinus tract, and they're like, just, you know, measure the whole axilla, count that as one thing, and then, you know, quantify the amount of drainage. Is it moderate? Is it heavy? Is it mild? And then they can use that, or your ambulatory case managers can work with you if you're at a, you know, a larger institution, to try to get some of those things covered where you may not have to be the person who's doing a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of wound care or big organizations that can help with trying to get wound care supplies covered. So one company, for example, is called Rotech, and I have their order forms basically in my clinic. And same thing, Colleen, just like you said, you need to specify like length, depth of all the wounds, or, you know, maybe you could try to summative. And then, you know, did you sort of debride the wound a little bit, like by cleaning it with some gauze or something? So there's all these like criteria, which it's helpful sometimes to talk to someone who's familiar with what the criteria are so that it doesn't bounce back to you. It basically requires like filling out the form every 3 months. And then they send the patient this, they basically, the company then tries to get it covered by insurance as much as they can. And then they provide the patient with like a month's supply of what should be able to help them based on what you wrote in your note. So I think it's definitely feasible, but if there's time constraints and stuff like that, I think, you know, other people like tips and tricks, they can try to go for like bulk supplies of like ABD pads or gauze pads, you know, sanitary pads for women or like adolescent girls. You know, some of my patients also have looked into Hydrowear, the, you know, the system that was sort of designed by a patient that tries to limit the amount of adhesive that actually touches the skin, because a large part is also like, besides the dressing, like what's going to keep the dressing in place, right? And some people don't even want to use any adhesive. They want to try to use biker shorts, right, or certain things to keep things stable. So I think Hydrowear is another one that, you know, might, some patients might want to look into. But I do think that for wound care, a large part of it for us, at least in the U.S., is cost.
What challenges are you all facing with prescribing these medications? And specifically, as in this case, how has the introduction of biosimilars for adalimumab changed the practice?
I think I'm lucky. I have yet to encounter a biosimilar issue or have it brought up to me, but I don't know if that's just because I don't practice with adults beyond seeing consults. So I don't see adults, so I haven't yet had an insurance company try to make me use a biosimilar in a child, but maybe it's just that in my bubble in Texas, I have not yet encountered it. Sounds like it's coming. I will say, you know, just for challenges in prescribing the medications, like, you know, once you get out of standard dosing, then I feel like good luck, like, here we go, you know, Wild West, let's have a little battle over this. And I feel like, you know, tips and things like, you know, including photos is helpful to be like, you know, it's harder for, I think, them to deny certain things if the patient gives you permission to show photos. So I think that can be helpful when you're fighting the battle with insurance. But I guess I would love to hear about biosimilars and what y'all have encountered, because it sounds like it's coming for me.
I think there's been good and bad. It's confusing because there's so many. They all have weird names. And just having so many players out there can get very kind of confusing and overwhelming. The positive side of things I have found is that with more competition, they're willing to throw in some perks. So some companies are offering like a free dietitian session, or, you know, they'll pay for adalimumab levels if you need them, whereas that was just a nightmare to get before for us. So I think that has been really positive.
And I would just add to that, that some of the biosimilars are less painful to inject. So kids that have been on both have told us that, I think it's the citrate that they don't have to. So it makes it a little bit more comfortable for the patient.
There's so many different ones that, just like you were saying, Irene, I think it's important when, you know, let's say you are given a letter that's like, you have to choose XYZ. It's nice to choose the one that like fits you. Like, you want to find the one that also offers an 80 milligram pen. If the patient is on 80 milligrams of adalimumab every 2 weeks, you don't want to switch them to 40 milligrams. And now they're like, why do I have to do two injections, right? And I think citrate-free is also another important quality to look for. Certainly, it's been here in California, we've had massive numbers of messages coming in telling us we have to switch patients from Humira to XYZ. And I do think that, you know, for me, what I just really don't want is a lapse in treatment. I don't want the patient to like not get their Humira anymore, and some miscommunication happened, and now they don't have their biosimilar, and then now they're going to tell me it doesn't work as well. So I'm really on the lookout for those emails, and I'm starting to like tell patients too, when I'm seeing them for follow-up, let me know if you get anything in the mail, let me know if like something's coming up where they're saying you have to switch. Thus far, I haven't seen like differences. It's been earlier, you know, but I haven't seen differences where someone's like, oh, I switched and immediately I haven't noticed like the same efficacy. So that's good. And we do have data done in the, at least in the infliximab literature with HS, suggesting that biosimilars can be similarly effective. So for me, I try to tell patients, like, we would expect it to work the same. Let me know, you know, if you run into any new issues with this. But that way, like we're setting them up for hopefully like a positive experience, and not biasing them towards like, I'm getting like a product that's not as good. How come insurance is making me switch? You know, I think that the way we think about how something's going to work is also important, probably an attestment to why placebo rates can be so high sometimes in HS. I think it's important. So I want to just set up my patients for the best chance of success. So that's how I've been counseling about biosimilars.
Is this something where just out of the blue, the insurance is like, ha, surprise, you need to switch? Or is this, you know, from the get-go, you're ordering it with certain plans and they're just like, no, you can't have, you know, adalimumab. We want you to use, you know, XYZ biosimilar, or is it all of the above?
Both. And I'll be honest, even the specialty pharmacies are having a little bit of a tough time with it, because depending on what person, my, you know, nurse who works on all of our biologics, like, she's very well versed in the prior authorization process. And there have still been times where she's called and they've been like, oh, no, it's not that biosimilar that's covered. It's this biosimilar that's covered. So then we'll send a new one and they'll be like, no, that biosimilar is not covered. This one is covered. And it just, even if you think that you know what you're doing, sometimes it does get a little complicated and confusing. And I definitely have had those patients. The only time this has been a problem for me is when we have had a significant lapse in treatment of a month or two while it's taken time to get it figured out, or we didn't hear from the insurance company, but the patient did. And by the time they tell us, by the way, I've been off my medication for a month, many of those patients have not been able to recapture the efficacy that they had before, which is very frustrating when I had a medication that was working and now I have to throw it in the trash because of an insurance change.
Our last case is going to be linked to part of this discussion that we're having, just because one of the other things that some of the biosimilar companies are offering is to be able to do levels and check for antibodies when we're treating our patients with their biosimilar. The last case that we wanted to bring up is that of a 14-year-old that presents to our office for a second opinion. So she has early stage 3 disease with at least 5 draining tunnels and more than 10 painful nodules when we see her. She's currently on adalimumab, 80 milligrams weekly, spironolactone, and doxycycline. And she feels that originally when she started the adalimumab, it was very helpful for her. Her disease was getting better. But as the months have gone by, the response has waned. And especially over the last 3 months, like, she doesn't feel that it is doing anything anymore. How are you approaching patients that stop responding, that initially had a good response and then stop responding to adalimumab? Are you checking levels? Are you checking antibodies? And where do you go next?
Yeah, so I feel like this is, you know, we were talking about this earlier, right? That like adalimumab, it's for, I would say, the majority of patients have at least some response, but then the majority of patients also, I think, lose response, right? And it's just a matter of when. And so I think it depends. I haven't developed like a strict algorithm yet in terms of like everybody. I just decide to check levels, et cetera. Sometimes, you know, if I feel like they're like losing some efficacy, but overall still doing okay, I might just ask them, do you feel like it's, you know, 80 milligrams every 2 weeks, it's like not as good during that second week? In which case for me, I'm like, maybe instead of doing the whole checking levels thing, maybe I'll just push to try for 80 milligrams weekly. And then see if we can recapture that. And then they can be like, okay, I didn't have a chance to not do as well. But in terms of checking levels, you know, if one were to do it, we'd want to check basically their sort of trough. So maybe the day that they're going to do the injection or the day before, you want to get the level. At the time, you can also just get the anti-drug antibody level. I think there's like different algorithms that tell you if it's high, you know, or low, you would get it. But I just get both at the same time, just so we don't have to do multiple sticks. And then basically based on the results of that, for example, if the anti-drug antibody level is really high and their serum trough level is low, you might be like, okay, well, instead of trying to push that dose, Maybe I want to switch to a different agent, you know? And for me, for someone like this who's coming in with this picture, for me, that would be thinking about either probably infliximab or secukinumab, just based on data that's out there and the fact that secukinumab now has FDA approval for 18 and up. The fact that there's any FDA label on it for HS, I think still helps us to get it. But certainly would like to hear if other people are just routinely always checking to do therapeutic drug monitoring. Because I think we spoke earlier to Irene about how like the levels that it should be at also just aren't really well defined yet also. So it just makes it a little bit harder sometimes, I think, if it's not a clear picture from the drug level and the anti-drug antibody level. So
I agree with you, Jenny. I'm still sort of trying to figure it out. But I think for me, especially for like a secondary non-responder, so somebody who had response but is losing it, I'm trying to do the levels more now that they're more available to patients. They don't have to pay for them as often now that they're pretty much all on biosimilars. I think it just helps have information. You know, if they don't have antibody levels and their level is on the low side, we can push the dose. And I'm really trying to emulate my GI colleagues more, where they rely so heavily on drug levels to inform their dosing strategy. I agree with you. I'm turning more to secukinumab as a second line after failing adalimumab, although I can't let go the worry in the back of my mind about the IBD signals that came out in some of the psoriasis trials, just because adolescents are at the age when inflammatory bowel disease tends to develop. And so we always worry that we might trigger or unmask an inflammatory bowel disease in one of our patients. Hasn't happened yet, but
I feel like I learned about all of this while working on our PEDRA research study on biologics in HS. Like, I admit I hadn't heard about checking antibodies or checking levels routinely until we were kind of gathering helpful feedback about what to include in that survey. And so then I took a dive into the literature, and like you guys were describing, I feel like I still was confused. I'm like, well, what level am I looking for? You know, it's just, it wasn't, yeah, exactly. It was very gray. It was not super black or white. So I feel like in my day-to-day practice, if someone was responding and they're responding less well, then I've typically had pretty good success in terms of getting approval for 80 milligrams weekly. Like, that has been an easier step. So I have often gone to that. I think when I'm getting past that, then that's definitely something that I would consider doing. Those orders are basically linked in our EMR. So I would get a level and antibodies at the same time, regardless, even if I'm not 100% sure exactly what I'm looking for. But if they have antibodies, then I feel like it is more, it probably pushes me a little more to think like, maybe I need to switch classes. Maybe I need to go to secukinumab. And that's another reason I can argue with insurance about why perhaps I shouldn't do infliximab, right? Why I should go to this other class first. So that's how I'm utilizing them right now. But I have a feeling, maybe ask me in a few years and I'll have a different answer or a more nuanced one, at least.
I have two things. One I just actually ran into today, which was, again, with the biosimilars, I had a patient who had previously been on Humira. She had failed it, was doing infliximab. She failed that. So now I was trying to get her secukinumab. And her insurance came back and said, but you have to try and fail our preferred adalimumab product. You have to try and fail this biosimilar. And I was so thankful because I had done drug levels on her when she was not responding well to the Humira. So I was able to say, she has anti-adalimumab antibodies. No adalimumab, your preferred biosimilar or not, is going to work for her. Is that true? I don't know. But I was able to say it at least, and I was able to use that. So I think I am now, any patient who I'm thinking of taking off of whatever biosimilar or brand name adalimumab they're on, I'm probably going to start getting levels, because I have a feeling I'm going to run into that again, especially as the preferred biosimilar changes from, you know, company to company. So that's one thing I'm probably going to use it for. I have not been checking everybody routinely, because when I started to do that, I found patients who were doing great on it, who supposedly had undetectable levels and super high antibody levels. And I'm like, well, that doesn't fit with what I'm seeing. So I guess we're still just going to try it out and see how it goes. But I am more using it just if they're losing efficacy or if I'm trying to make an argument with the insurance company. And the other thing that I'm doing a lot with my patients is when I start a biologic with them, I am setting the stage that I am going to be doing surgery once we get them to the point where things are even like slightly better. Because I do find that the longer my patients wait to go to surgery, the more likely they are to lose that effect of their biologic even faster. And I think with everything we're learning about the pro-inflammatory nature of these biofilms and these tunnels, you know, I think that my patients, I have several patients who I have put on a biologic. We've been able to do procedures. They have come off their biologic and they've been okay. They have not flared up again after we were able to get rid of those tunnels. It's not necessarily a guarantee or necessarily that common, but it is something where I'm now sort of prefacing that discussion right at the beginning where I say this is a really important thing that we need to use in conjunction with our biologics.
This is such a great conversation. I'm here taking notes of new tricks and ideas on how to do this very complex management of patients with HS. I do agree with Colleen. I think previously, like years ago, I kind of learned this idea that we had to wait for the inflammation to kind of subside before sending them to surgery. And I think more and more, we were trying to kind of make those referrals to our surgery colleagues earlier, because we do find that they end up doing better if they have those interventions earlier. I don't think that we are waiting for the disease to be completely quiet before sending them off. I don't know if others are doing the same.
Also hard to be completely quiet a lot of times. I feel like I think once we've made significant inroads, it's like, okay, it's a win. Let's go ahead and see how you would do with surgery.
And then there are some patients that we just cannot get them to improve. No matter what we do, no matter what medications they are on, they keep getting worse. They keep getting all these horrible, painful nodules. They cannot go to school. The odor and the pain is kind of very limiting to their quality of life. What are you doing next? Like, are you using immunosuppressants? Are you doing our tapenem? Like, what else have you found useful in your very, very severe patients that I know probably right now we're all thinking of that patient that keeps us up at night thinking like, what am I going to do next? Because I ran out of options. Like, what are you doing?
I think phoning a friend, honestly. Like, I was just thinking of, I was talking to a colleague about one of her cases recently and, you know, came up with like, oh, like this particular instance was a kid that had, very recurrent nodules like on the scrotum in a Down syndrome patient, actually. And so we're just kind of talking through like, okay, what else could we do? And things like cycling antibiotics is something I haven't done as much, but we're talking about maybe trying that in this patient, you know, like just let's do doxy for 3 months and let's do clindamycin for 3 months, like kind of hitting with all those. And then also, you know, in this instance, like identifying something in someone in pediatric urology that could help with some of the surgical management of some of those areas we were a little less comfortable with. So I think going back to the idea, it's a team sport. So often if I feel like I've run out of ideas, someone sitting right next to me might have a very different approach or at least other ideas. And so that's very helpful.
One thing I struggle with is I would like to have more surgery for my patients, just like Colleen said, like doing medical and surgical care sort of in parallel. I think people generally say now is better for the patient and their overall disease control. But it's been hard to find surgeons who ascribe to that philosophy. You know, there's one surgeon in Toronto who sees all our patients and he's so busy. And so everybody waits to see him. But I mean, we need more people to learn about HS and to be interested in HS so that, like you said, it is a team sport. So that we have more players on the team.
And I will say I do a lot of that surgery myself. I mean, you can really, even if you're just doing deroofings, you can do staged deroofings. If you have somebody that you really can't get them to someone who's going to do like a wide local excision or going to do a flap or something like that. I have a handful of patients that are just, they're just awful. Everything is like a mass of interconnected webs. But and there was a patient who was just like, I just can't go anywhere else. So I was like, all right, well, I'm gonna do like this half of your axilla. And she was so happy afterwards, even though she still had all these other areas. She was like, that one area doesn't bother me anymore. So can you do all the rest of them? So it takes time, but I think you can stretch it a little bit for some patients who maybe should be going to a surgeon. I think we can do some of these stage de-roofings at times.
Where I practice, I have Vanessa Pena, Dr. Pena, who's awesome and very much into the procedural aspect. And I feel like I've been trying to channel more of that to be like, okay, I didn't train with this when I was in training, but I can be taught. And I think that it's actually, like you said, a very ripe area for maybe where we could be doing a bit more for our patients. And maybe that's just something where, you know, at like SPD and other avenues that we have some of these training sessions so that we can go out and kind of tackle some of these when they're less severe. And then, yes, still, of course, lean on our surgical colleagues for some of the bigger cases that would keep us up at night. But we could at least intervene earlier on some of our patients.
One thing that we haven't mentioned is laser and laser hair removal. Are you doing this yourselves? Are you sending patients to colleagues to have laser? And one thing that one of our dermatology colleagues swears by is actually lasering pyonidal cysts and some of the HS lesions. Have you done this? Are you seeing some of these treatments successful in your patients?
I think laser hair removal can be a really helpful adjunct therapy, and especially for our patients when we're seeing them when they're milder and it's not like there's all these sinus tracts or tunnels in the way. And a lot of times the patients themselves really want it because they're struggling with the shaving aspect or the waxing aspect, and you know, and they want to be like have their hair groomed a certain way. And so for me, I think it really depends on access to laser hair removal. So unfortunately, like our institution didn't have a laser hair removal. We got one now for county, and I'm so excited that I'm going to be able to use it for my county patients. But, you know, I think with the NDAG, you can basically do a whole like armpit really quickly in seconds, and then maybe try to like for some of those nodules, you can double pulse them to see if it can help as well. And I think that, so laser, and definitely want to see if other people have comments about laser hair removal, but that I also will also do like botulinum toxin injections for some of my patients who I think can handle it. So some of my like older adolescent patients, if they also, for example, really say like sweating makes it worse or they're athletes, you know, I think that that's something else that we can talk about. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, hyperhidrosis therapies, which I'm sure Jen Ruth would love to comment on, but I think that, you know, that's another thing that procedurally, you know, that I'm able to do for patients as well.
Yeah, I totally missed my cue earlier when we were talking about sweating and odor. I'm like, oh yeah, we should have brought up sweating. You can control sweating. I love injecting kids with Botox. It's great. That one I feel like I have harder access to like cost-wise. We're lucky in that we have an NDAG and Alex in clinic. And so that's something that we routinely get approved, actually probably majority for patients with pyonidal cysts, just because of surgery in our area has learned that we have this and that we can get approved. So I feel like every patient with a pyonidal cyst they send through. So I have lasered a lot of butts. It works very well for pyonidal cysts and also and for the HS community as well, like you're describing for some of those patients on the more mild side. I think it's a really helpful adjunct therapy. And when we can get, you know, Medicaid and insurance to cover it, like that's just another helpful piece of the pie.
I think it's also tough the amount of time that it takes to get that covered sometimes. Like I know that, you know, depending on the insurances in our area, some of them, quote unquote, cover the cost of laser hair removal, but it's like $20, which is not, you know, doesn't cover the cost of the laser, doesn't cover, you know, the time that they're in the clinic and with the ice pack and the numbing cream and like all that kind of thing. So a lot of my patients I do actually send out to specific individuals, either other physicians or, you know, people that I trust who have a reduced cost, like a reduced cash payment for HS patients for laser hair removal. As I do think, you know, it's something that I'm still struggling with in my practice is how can I make this feasible where I can continue to provide it for everybody without just like losing a ton of money on it and not being able to do it for anybody.
I think it's helpful too if you end up doing more and more of it, because I'll say like our staff help me out a lot in that like we're seeing laser patients in 15-minute visits just like our clinic patients, and they're just mixed in, but the staff is like, all right, We've, you know, if it's their first time, we've shaved them, we've put on the numbing, we've, you know, they've kind of got everything prepped. So, like, bless our staff and those that support us, because they help make it feasible too.
I think one of the things that we wanted all of you to comment on is research and management. So what do you think are the hot topics or the things that we should be pursuing to do research on regarding the management of pediatric HS?
No, you're fine. I was just saying I'm biased because we still have our biologics and HS study, which we're wrapping up data collection on. So shout out to everyone that's contributed to that. So I'm really excited to see what that data shows. And then already I'm like, oh man, I wish we had even included maybe a few more years, like even more recent years. I feel like the landscape of how people are using these medications is changing so much that perhaps after we finish this one, like, we're going to need to do another.
Yeah, I was going to say we need options. We need more options for our more severe patients. And I think that's coming. I think there are more drugs that are going to be approved imminently for adolescents. So that's great. And then once we have those drugs, I think helping us understand which phenotype will respond to which medication is like a huge, huge gap for me. I have no idea who's going to respond to adalimumab and who's not. And it's kind of just a toss-up. So many patients just don't respond. I think defining phenotypes and then understanding which, or even biomarkers or some characteristic that helps us understand which path to venture down in terms of drugs.
Along those lines, really understanding that natural history of progression more, just like along the lines of phenotyping, like, you know, is this someone who's sitting across from me with just those like few comedones, right? Like in the story of like sometimes having pimples, like, is this going to be like a rapid progressor where I'm like, maybe just come to me monthly? Or is it going to be someone who kind of hangs around like this for a few years and like it becomes just very mild HS even down the line in their 20s and 30s? I would love to be able to have a better sense of how to counsel patients who are asking me like, well, what do you think is going to happen to my HS? You know, I think right now I'm just like, well, it's different for everyone. You know, we just want to control it the best we can for you. But it'd be really nice to be able to have more information to share with patients.
I think kind of on the biomarker side of things, you know, a lot of the studies that have been done of HS tissue in particular have been done from patients who are early stage 3. We're getting procedures and removing these tunnels, which makes sense to me. But the way I kind of think about it is, I think back to medical school where somebody told me that you can listen to babies cry, and if they're early in their cry, you can actually tell like what it is that they're asking for, if they're like chill and calm at the beginning. But if you wait until they're screaming, they're just screaming. You can't tell what it is that they want. And I kind of think that way about HS too, is that, you know, some people start differently, but by the time they get to stage 3, like, it's all just a mess. Like, the inflammation is everywhere. Every inflammatory marker is off the charts. So I would really like to see some of those studies in adolescents, in these patients who are new and coming in maybe with just the open comedones, or coming in with, you know, one or two flares, to understand what's the first thing that's going off the rails. Can we use those things to phenotype patients and determine what they would respond to, and maybe understand why this happens to some people and doesn't happen to others who you might think with their comorbidity burden it should happen to?
Lots of work to do. So we have to discuss more of these projects in our PEDRA, Acne and HS working group. I'm just very grateful for everybody being here and all the wonderful conversation that has taken place.
I want to just say one thing back when we were talking about like when somebody has failed everything, like, what do you do? I do want to put a plug in for IV ertapenem. I have not done that very often. I have done it, I think, in 3 patients so far in my career, but all of those patients were suicidal because of the severity of their disease. All of those patients needed a quick solution. They needed to have some hope that things were going to get better. And I do think in the right patient, that treatment, you know, if they can do a PICC line, if they can, you know, administer these antibiotics at home, if you trust them to transition to a maintenance
biologic therapy of some sort, and to get them in with a surgeon as soon as possible while they're on that ertapenem to get some of that surgery done, I think it can be life-saving in some of these patients.
I completely agree, Colleen. And I think that is or should be our next case series, just because I think that there's not a lot of literature about doing this in pediatric patients. And I do think that for a subset of patients, it is very useful. So thank you all so much. We deeply appreciate your participation and hope to continue our conversation in podcast number 3.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for having us.
A very special thank you to Dr. Rebecca Levy, Dr. Jennifer Ruth, and Dr. Jennifer Shao for participating in this panel discussion today. Thank you also to our program hosts, Dr. Irene Lara Corrales and Dr. Colleen Cotton. Lastly, thank you very much to our program supporters, Insight and Novartis, for supporting this independent medical education program. For more content, please visit Peter's website at peterresearch.org. If you have questions, please email us at info@peterresearch.org. Make sure you're subscribing to the Pedra Pearls podcast channel wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure that you're following us on social media @PedraResearch so you never miss an update. Thanks for listening.